you would have to say that life has meaning or it doesn't. And if it doesn't, why not commit suicide? As Albert Camus said, the only philosophical question is whether we should commit suicide. Or life does have meaning, and if it does have meaning, nothing can detract from it. So Frankl felt that life had meaning, and he put his trust in that. It's a kind of transcendental trust in the meaningfulness of being. Now, of course, as you rightly say, some people don't feel the meaning, don't find their purpose in life, and they're floundering in what Dr. Frankl calls the existential vacuum. And of course, in the concentration camps, people used to run into the barbed wire to kill themselves. And he had set up a suicide pavilion trying to help people. And he'd also done it before in the polyclinic in Vienna in Austria. He'd also done it as well in youth counselling centres. And in fact, when he did it, introduced logotherapy to young people, Austria, or Vienna in particular, which had the highest rate of suicide, didn't have one suicide the following year, thanks to logotherapy. So it's extraordinary. So the big question is, how do you find meaning in life, especially in the most miserable of circumstances? And the answer is the following, that there are three main pathways to meaning. Frankl loves his triad, so everything is in threes in Frankl, you know. He talks about the tragic triad, which is suffering, guilt and death, but there's also the triumphant triad of healing, meaning and forgiveness. So in other words, he would advance what he calls the case for tragic optimism. Because pessimism sees only the darkness. Optimism can be very upbeat, but frankly not rooted in reality. Tragic optimism is saying yes to life in spite of everything, but aware that there's the tragic dimension, but always moving towards the triumphant of healing, meaning and forgiveness. They have the last word, not the tragic dimension. And for Frankl, life, even if we've given up on life still expects something from us. So that's the question he puts to people. What is life expecting of us? Maybe there's a work to be done that only we can do, a deed to be done, a person to love in his uniqueness, or to bear our sufferings in an honourable way, in a right way. And how you do that is that there's no meaning in suffering in itself. I mean, suffering is meaningless and you don't court it. That's masochism. But if it happens to you, and you, what do you do with it? You've only one way to deal with it, and that's to choose your attitude towards it. It's how you respond to it. So as he quotes Nietzsche, he who has a why to live for can cope with almost any how. Nature, culture, art, they give meaning. When the experiences are taken from us, when creations are taken from us, in other words, let's say we're dying and in an unbearable way with an inoperable cancer, all that's left to us is the attitude inside our own mind, how we respond to things. As I think it was Epictetus who said, men are disturbed not by things, but by the interpretation the mind puts on them. And Frankl said, the Nazis took away everything from him, but the only thing they couldn't take was the attitude inside his own mind. And that's where, in our residual freedom, we can choose how to respond to suffering. And he calls that the last of the human freedoms.
And this is Holy Week. Does any of that translate into a Christian context as well, or was he primarily looking at it from a secular point of view, or did he look at people's religious and transcendental experiences as well, or their religious and cultural understandings as well?
So that's a big question. So a number of things to say there. The first is that he was a practicing Jew. And I think Ellie told us once that when he was dying in hospital, the doctor wanted to get into the room and she was guarding and said, no, you can't come in. Dr. Frankl is at his prayers. And he prayed in the camp. So we know he was a Jew, a man of faith, and he prayed. The second thing is, of course, he wants to attract into logotherapy people who are believers, Jews, Muslims, Christians, but also those who don't believe. So he tries to retain it as a more secular science. The next point to make is he does distinguish between the meaning of the moment. So the meaning of the moment for me now is to look at you here with the microphone, to talk as clearly as I can, to try and answer your questions. That's the meaning of my moment. So meanings of the moment are unique, they're singular, they're variable, they're changeable. But there is what he also calls ultimate meaning. And the question is whether, of course, he means by ultimate meaning God. And he defines God once as the partner in my most intimate soliloquy. Now, I'm not going to say that ultimate meaning equals God, but logotherapy takes seriously the spiritual dimension of the person. But by that, he doesn't necessarily mean the religious. For the theist, it can mean that. But it can mean, it's really the specifically human dimension. We have conscience, the will to meaning, love. All these things are what he calls part of the spiritual dimension of the person. The pneumogenic, from the Greek word, and coming into the Latin meaning nous or spirit. But he was a believer, and I suppose when he was asked once, what is the meaning of life? He says, the universal answer to the meaning of life is a religious question. And in fact, he couldn't answer that because he says it's like asking a man who's playing chess, what's the best move of the game? The best move is dictated by the how of the game. So, but he does also say then that biology concentrates on life as cells and molecules and atoms. Psychology concentrates on a higher level of life, which is life as mind. But theology is the queen of the sciences because it takes God as ultimate object. And that's higher. So it's overarching. Just as psychology overarches biology, so too does theology overarch psychology. And I suppose one difference is that religion aims at salvation, logotherapy aims at mental health, but the two aren't incompatible.
Do you think the issues of meaning and mental health are big issues for Ireland? We do have one of the highest rates of suicide, particularly amongst young men. And why do you think that's the case?
The statistics are staggering. I actually, a few years ago, organised the first conference on suicide and logotherapy in town in the European Parliament buildings with Gay Mitchell. I mean, yes, I think that people who are thinking of ending their lives, they are escaping from the sometimes sad human scene. They have lost meaning and purpose. So clearly the answer is to find meaning and purpose. And that's the big challenge, whether they do it through finding God or painting or music or friendship. But the main thing is that people need to realize that, you know, the dark clouds of depression are there, but they pass. Behind the dark clouds is the sun on the logos horizon of life. Meaning is never wanting. It's always waiting, waiting to be realized, waiting to be actualized. None of us knows what magnificent hour may still await us. And we're called to endure and to, I suppose, build a legacy of meaning and a life of purpose. Not to be happy. That's not the aim of life. Life doesn't owe you happiness. It offers you meaning. And I think if you put meaning and purpose first, and that may include an explicitly theistic way of looking at things, then everything else will follow. Everything else is given to you.
Do you think we focus more on the happiness side, the sort of instant gratification aspect of life?
I think that if you take happy Christmas, happy Easter, people are pushing happiness. It's almost a right, like the American Declaration of Independence promises it, you know, the right to the pursuit of happiness. If you want to be happy, maybe you need to go to the States. But the notion here is that happiness is a far cry from how Aristotle mentioned when he talked about eudaimonia, which means to be in spirit. It means a kind of spiritual happiness or joy. I wrote a book actually on the subject of happiness a few years ago called The Ethics of Happiness, and I distinguish, as you rightly said, between pleasure, happiness and joy. Pleasure is somatic, it's bodily. It's almost, you could say, happiness at the level of the body. But chasing pleasure is what thwarts pleasure. It's called the pleasure trap. Sometimes called the pleasure paradox. Too much pleasure is painful. Think of tickling somebody. It's very pleasurable. And then they go, stop, stop, stop. It's painful. So it's actually self-defeating. If you take happiness, which is something psychological or mental, it's in the mind. It's how we respond to the event. And then spiritual happiness is joy. So joy is noetic. It's spiritual happiness. And that's different from pleasure and different from happiness. So the higher dimensions transcend but include the lower. So you can have pleasure without happiness, but you can't have happiness without pleasure. And mental health and happiness is when we fire in all three cylinders, somatic, psychological and noetic. So in other words, if at the level of the body, when I take sleep, exercise, nutrition, the level of the mind, emotional security, intellectual curiosity, and then spirit, when I'm either meditating or praying or will to meaning, following my conscience, loving somebody in their uniqueness, this is the way we all need to live. And this has been occluded, as you rightly said, in this kind of hysterical, hedonistic hunt for happiness. That's not ultimately what life is about.
And for anybody listening now, and they may be reflecting because it is Holy Week and it is a time for reflection, what kind of things could they think about, or what way could they be focusing their mind? Even if they're not particularly religious, people are still aware that it is, you know, it is a significant season, it is a significant time of year.
So if they're religious, of course, they're looking at their lives against the backdrop of the Son of Man entering into human history, the Logos incarnate, and his terrible suffering, Good Friday, which is crucifixion, resurrection on Sunday. Look at it more symbolically. That represents all of us in the pits and peaks of life, in our melancholia and in our mania. We all feel crucified. We've all experienced Gethsemane and Golgotha, which is the death of the spirit, a strangulation. And we've all experienced a resurrection when a breakdown can lead to a breakthrough. So Frankl would ask us to deploy what he calls the defiant power of the human spirit. And that is our essence. And that self-transcendent, neurogenic energy in us, once it's poured into the body and mind and spirit, it can elevate us and it can permit us to deal with all these blows of fate. So I suppose it's about, I often think Saturday, Holy Saturday, is staying in that place between crucifixion and resurrection, waiting in the void with its promise of nothingness. But there's life lessons to be learned there, because if we try and escape it too quickly, it's the flight into hell. So linger a while and see what it's being asked of you. Where are you in life? What is your purpose in life? What will be your lasting legacy, your contribution to creation? Ask yourself, where do I find purpose and meaning in what? What gives me hope? What gives me peace? What gives me consolation rather than anxiety or desolation? And to follow your logo hook, to follow your bliss, because meaning sets the pace for being.